Hello again, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Hashtag Pooligans podcast. My name is Daniel, and you can follow me on Twitter at d_twit. Today, we are celebrating the release of our 15th episode, and so for our new listeners, just a quick recap, Hashtag Pooligans is a fan podcast inspired by Julie Mason and SiriusXM's POTUS Press Pool. We discuss politics and all other matters of import, big or small, with fellow Julie fans or special guests, and today's guest may just be what we all need after this week's news avalanche. Just minutes ago, the good senators advanced Judge Kavanaugh's nomination through cloture to a final vote on Saturday. It's been another week of confusion and ugliness, an FBI investigation that appears to have been stunted by the White House, and an ultimate decision that will no doubt figure into the midterm elections in a significant way, no matter what the results of tomorrow's vote. And that, dear listeners, is why today's guest may be just the bomb that you require on this here Friday. Current affairs is kept to a minimum in our talk, and we instead focus on his long and storied career, the national security apparatus after 9/11, foreign travel, healthcare systems, and why having a podcast can feel rather freeing. He's a fascinating man who generously agreed to come on the podcast to share his insights in his unique dulcet tones, sure to soothe you even after a week-long rash of politics-induced hives. And with that, let us not tarry and meet our latest Hashtag Pooligan. Please enjoy. And here we are with our latest Hashtag Pooligans and Friends podcast with another fascinating Julie listener who just so happens to also be a luminary of many fields and a wearer of many hats. Behind the innocuous Twitter handle hides a man who has been deeply involved in aspects of digital communication that we all take for granted these days. Don't take this the wrong way, but he probably worked on your inbox. His work experience has spanned that small company in Redmond, national security, the healthcare field, digital imaging, and many more. He's a sailing enthusiast and a cherished father and grandfather whose voice could soothe even the most aggrieved of savage beasts. Ladies and gentlemen, you should, of course, follow at JohnM0100 on Twitter. He is John Maury. John, welcome.
It is so great to be here, Daniel. Thank you.
I'm already hearing that you have an adult beverage, I believe, with you. I hear some very convincing ice cube clinking. That is excellent.
And some Perrier, too.
And some Perrier for later on. Okay, good, good, good.
You know, when you start something like this, some people might hear it in the morning, but we're doing this in the evening, so there you go.
Yes, you're having an evening beverage after having done a full work day, put your adorable grandchildren to bed, and now we're here with an adult beverage as intended.
Yes.
So, John, since you are a active POTUS Press Pool listener, we're going to start all of this with our questionnaire. We'll get straight into it, and then we'll continue for a very long time. Okay. John, where do you stand, would you say, on the political spectrum?
I'm pretty much left of center. There, every day these days, I keep questioning how progressive I am versus how centrist I am. But it's pretty fair to say that the only time I look at Fox is to try and understand what they're thinking, how they're thinking about it, and truly trying to understand why the other side of the world is parsing things the way they are.
Have you come to any conclusions?
Yeah, some of it relates to a lot of lifelong stuff about people. I've often tried to define demographics in something called VALS, V-A-L-S, values and lifestyles, which attempts to understand people and groups and cohorts based on their values, their attitudes and needs and expectations. And if anything, the last election helped to illuminate for our country this very disparate set of values and attitudes and how to try and understand them. And it compelled me to reach out to lots of friends who I pretty much guessed were Trump supporters to try and understand why and how. And so, if anything, the past few years have been illuminating and awakening lots of folks about those vast chasms and trying to understand how we as Americans can figure this out. I don't know if that made any sense.
But... No, that definitely makes sense. However, I will have to get you back to that later on, because I'd love to talk to you about what exactly it is that you found out in your journey into understanding the Trump voter, because God knows we've heard enough people on the POTUS press pool and read enough people in major newspapers trying to do just that, and with mixed results, I would say.
Sure.
So I'm really curious what your personal experiences were. And we'll definitely get to that after a whole bunch of other stuff that we're also going to get to. We're going to add that to the list.
Okay.
Do you, as far as the POTUS press pool is concerned, do you remember when the POTUS press pool came into your life?
I was in the car and driving, and I could hear Julie's voice. And then there was a little click because she mentioned something about her connection to Massachusetts. And I thought that was cool because I am a native of just outside of Boston. And these days I absolutely claim myself to be both a resident of Greater Boston and the Bay Area of San Francisco. And then it was her humor and her spunkiness and her wisdom and her experience. And I said, you know, to use the phrase, holy shit. Here's someone who just has not only her insight, but then guests who just come on. And so it was fun to make politics fun. And now I don't like to think that I'm addicted to anything, because there are days when I don't get to listen. And there are actually days like now when Julie's on vacation, but, I listen to the evening recording sometimes, but it's just so nice, especially when I'm on the West Coast here, as you might be, Daniel, to get it, you know, earlier in the day and listen. And it's so refreshing and real. And she is, she should describe herself, but, you know, whether it's middle of the road or at least skeptical of all things, it's terrific. And no BS. So I am a Julie fan for sure.
We can tell, John. We can tell. Yeah. Well put. Do you? And I think we already also partially are into our second question, which is what it is that brings you back to the POTUS press pool. Obviously, there are a lot of different offerings that are now available. There's podcasts like what we are doing right now of all sorts. There are other radio channels, other options. What is it that brings you back to the POTUS press pool in particular?
You could be up on Mars, but I'm out in the Bay Area, or I could be traveling in Asia or wherever, and you hear very timely stuff, and then you can send Julie a text or the producers there, and maybe if it's a useful question, they'll talk about it. And so there are mornings I wake up and I go, oh my God, I really want an answer or a discussion about this topic. And sure enough, and I'm not claiming that I send something and they cover it, but you're just voting it and saying, this is interesting. Please help me with this real-time thing that's happening, because we are all pretty much now victims of real-time news feeds and things like that.
Yeah, that often feel like they're cascading over one another at an increasingly desperate rate. It's a crazy, crazy news cycle. Do you, once you've listened to the program, do you feel like a better informed listener? And do you share the information that you glean in the press pool with anybody around you?
Oh my gosh, yes, for sure. There are people all around me that we talk about, and I know folks that listen to it. So sometimes the evenings or you know, dinner time or evening is crazy and busy with young children and others, but sometimes we get a chance to talk about it. And if not even that day, then maybe the next day. So everything is topical. And Lord knows, I know it sounds like a commercial, but it's really useful and important and helpful. And thank God, sometimes even funny.
Yeah, that is a value in and of itself, because all of this news can seem pretty grim at times, no?
Yes, no, it's huge. And Julie has this very useful skill at grounding and saying, so let's look at history and we've been here before. You know, there was a very useful thing, not to bring up lots of stuff, but in Vanity Fair, Doris Kearns Goodwin, just in the past few days, an article comparing Trump to Teddy Roosevelt, and Teddy is one of my heroes. And so it's the kind of thing that Julie could have written about comparing, contrasting quality versus, let's say, not so quality, and what's wrong with the current discourse and the current vibe and the current reality of what's in Washington.
You mentioned it earlier briefly. How do you feel about the Twitter interaction with Julie? Is that something that you seek out? Do you enjoy getting your name read, as we know Pooligans are apt to?
The only time I try and get my name read is when Julie thinks I'm her brother, tweeting her. because, you know, John M., you know, so Mason. So at first she was wondering, was this my brother tweeting at me? But otherwise, no. I sometimes include an at Julie for just a piece. I'm not trying to build a Twitter following ever. I have a small group of folks I talk to on Twitter, and I really like her stuff when I see it. So I'm at this phase, you know, because I'm a quote tech guy in this rebound of the whole social media world and what Facebook and Twitter and blah, blah, blah are all trying to do, and trying to both use it as a user, but also within my group in Silicon Valley and in Boston, discuss. So where do we bring this? Because we're all trying to figure it out.
Which is interesting, because it also directly leads to our next question, which our small group of hashtag Pooligans, of people who really follow this POTUS press pool pretty much on a daily basis. Do you interact with any of them on Twitter? We just talked about you actually are one of the few Pooligans who has met another Pooligan in real life fairly recently. Do you interact with them on Twitter? Do you interact with them in real life?
No, just having fun interacting with different comments on Twitter and likes and things like that. That's really, really nice. And seeing people acknowledging my crazy comments on Twitter is really nice. And trying to understand what the hell you guys are talking about cheese so much for.
Are you not familiar with the mystery of the cheese?
I am not, just peripherally, you know. I like cheese, and I see it's one of those themes and memes, and so I'm happy to learn about it.
Yeah, this was of course brought to us by our friend Bubbles the Vampire, who's a huge cheese fan, and Olivier Knox, who's also a huge cheese fan, and several other of our Pooligans who are also huge cheese fans, so it just sort of became a thing.
Well, I think that we should weave some more grapes into that, because cheese and grapes and some nice French bread would be very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is. In fact, if you check our weekend podcasts, our new famous What the Fuck meter, it begins with one, have some cheese and some grapes, and am relaxed in my easy chair. So that is, in fact, the most relaxed any hashtag Pooligan can be, is the combination of cheese, grapes, and an easy chair.
Oh, well, then could I add with maybe a just a hint of heresy, that I'm a rosé fan, so cheese and grapes and French bread or bread.
A little rosé. Okay, we will add the rosé in your honor, John, from now on to the What the Fuck meet. We will add a nice Whispering Angel. Whispering Angel, maybe not the best, but definitely not the worst. Mm-hmm. Actually, we haven't done wine on the podcast at all.
Let's do that, because I am not an enophile at all. And so that's a good thing, because, you know, I'll drink whatever you put in front of me.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you have any favorites?
No, as I said. So if it's red, that's delicious. If it's rosé, that's delicious. Not as much a white wine fan, but...
But the rosé sort of hits your relaxed sweet spot.
Especially in the, you know, summer, late spring, summer, early fall. Why not?
How do you feel about Twitter as a medium? And is it something that you use for any particular purpose other than to just browse around a little bit?
And so today, the biggest thing is that some people get news, some people reach out to shout out, and I have not seen good hard data about the folks, the people in the U.S. We're talking about the U.S. We could talk about other parts of the world. What are they doing on Twitter? Why are they there? And what are they trying to accomplish? So there is some news, but it's kind of a public square in a good and bad sense. The Twitter folks are trying to figure that out too. And they are products of the Bay Area, which means they're mostly libertarian in the sense that they haven't picked stuff. They've just grown up a little politically agnostic, most of them, in my humble opinion. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to build something that they think will be good for everybody. And then they find out the pluses and negatives of it.
Public square is an interesting metaphor because they're having a really hard time coming to terms with what to do when there's a public stoning.
Absolutely.
In their public square. And I think that has been an enduring problem, particularly for this platform.
And when you get to travel, one of the most amazing things for me personally, as an American, in this case, going to London, and you know, I stayed up by Marble Arch, and on Sundays you go into the park, and you see folks getting up on their little soapboxes, mm-hmm. and talking, and there are many soapboxes, and you start to get a sense of how people can speak. When I help build Microsoft's email mm-hmm. stuff, we talked about the fact that by giving people these tools in those early days, people would be tempted to send what we called flame mail, right? We don't talk about it much these days, mm-hmm. but it's like flame Twitter or flame Facebook. But people would be uninhibited because they weren't looking at you one-on-one or sitting with you. Or sitting with people, that people would be humans with this new tool, would be uninhibited to send crazy ass stuff that was negative and awful and was flame mail. And so there's a bit of that today too.
Yeah, just a tiny bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just, and Twitter to, I guess, some partial credit at least, finally figured out how to get some of the more seriously egregious flamers, shall we say, off its platform. But it hesitated in a very recent example, for instance, with Alex Jones. Alex Jones hesitated for a good long time when almost every other platform had made up its mind that this was probably bad. Twitter hesitated for a long time, and It's not entirely clear to me what eventually precipitated his ouster. It appeared to be a direct confrontation of like two sentences with Jack personally. But it's strange, these groundkeeping on public squares where people get to express ideas is definitely not an easy thing. And has, as you point out, has not been since the very beginning.
Well, as you point out, some of this is personal, because there are humans at the helm of these things. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two is, let's take Dorsey, mm-hmm. or you know, pick any you know, from Sheryl Sandberg, mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg, these very human people trying to figure out what they should be doing to be supportive of democracy, because I believe they all are subscribers to democracy, and how to support discourse, dissent, and exchange of ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably hard, but
it appears so.
it appears so, but we just need to keep pounding on them, because they decide, right, independently, mm-hmm. that they want to be part of the leadership of that. And that's okay. And that's really good. And then we should hold them to that very highest standard of wisdom and insight and historical understanding of what has brought us here so far and what are the next steps, using everything about humanity and technology to bring us to the very best.
And that would be an excellent segue into your past at this point. But before we go there, despite your super excellent segue, I have one. I need to know from you, do you have any favorite press pool guests or moments with Julie Mason?
I have to say that Friday afternoons are the best because the weeks are so crazy and so the press pool is fun. And having, you know, just a round table is fun. And I'll also take this moment to take a little swipe at Julie because she is much better off not taking phone calls because she it's clear she doesn't like it, but also she doesn't need to do it. Sweet Jesus, God help us. You know, you don't need to do that stuff because it's far better just to talk to the good people and let Smirkanish, I love listening to Smirkanish in the morning, and he's got the people there. God bless him. But Julie, you know, you just keep your people there and do that. So I slip that in. You can let Julie know.
I appreciate that. We also today got news that Chris Cuomo is going to also have a call-in show now instead of the midday briefing. So the midday briefing today was replaced with a new CNN's Chris Cuomo is going to do a show with call-ins. So I think at that point, we're probably going to be all good on call-ins and look forward to the professionals.
Wow. You made my day. So help me. Can I just segue? Give me the rundown for the day. So Tim Farley in the morning.
Tim Farley, Smirkanish, Chris Cuomo, 1 hour of something, although... Yeah, I guess that too is shifting a little bit. And then Julie, and then Olivier.
Oh my God, my fall has been redeemed. That's great. There you go.
I'm glad that I brought something fresh to you tonight, John.
You're like Santa Claus, Daniel.
I came bearing gifts.
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
And speaking of an old man with a beard, we're now going to go 30 years into the past because, not to call you an old man with a beard, obviously, because first of all, you're not old. Second of all, you don't have a beard. But you are, functionally, the grandfather of what we now know as Microsoft Outlook, part of the Office suite of good things that comes to us from Microsoft, such as PowerPoint, Excel, and the infamous Word, all of which, or some of which, Word in particular, I've been using since the DOS days. So,
wow, DOS. Good
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, MS-DOS, yeah, still did that.
And are you using a PC or a Mac these days?
I use both.
Good for you.
I use both. I grew up with a father who loved, he had a Wang computer when...
Oh my God.
When that was the only word processor that existed. I had a Commodore 64 and a VIC-20.
Wow.
When those were still around. And so I grew up really with computers all my life since I can remember, pretty much as a young boy, since they came out. But you started something at a time when email had just stepped out of its, and now you'll correct me if I'm wrong, being a form of communication that was used by both the government and by universities.
Yes.
Primarily. Sure. Yep. And so I'm really curious, how did young John come into this particular business with Microsoft, and what were your dreams and expectations of what you got yourself into in the 80s?
Back in the mid 80s or even early 80s, you know, computers were coming on strong. And so people were starting to understand that this computer stuff could be on people's desktops or in homes. And some people got it, some people didn't. And I was a young person, professional, a dad, a husband in Boston and working in the mini computer industry. Back in Boston, Digital Equipment, Data General, Prime Computer, Wang Laboratories were all the big companies. And a company way, way out in Seattle, in fact, in Redmond, called and said, would you come out and help us build this new thing? And I said, you're all crazy. I'm happy here in Boston. But I went out and met a guy named Bill and talked to him and understood his vision was kind of aligned with my mediocre vision of where things were going. And so I moved my family out there for a pay cut and a chance to build something interesting. And that became, at first I was asked to lead this charge. It wasn't called Microsoft Office then. It was just called Integrated Office Systems. And I said very early on, let me just focus on email stuff. And so that's what I did.
What was it at that point that particularly fascinated you about the idea of email?
Oh, everything was connected early on, you know, because both IBM and those big kinds of companies, and then the mini computer companies, Wang, DEC, Data General, Prime, you saw the early instances of stuff being connected. And if you had any vision of all the technologies from imaging to email and connected computers and how people at work and at home could start to use that kind of stuff incredibly well and to increase their productivity, then if you had any percolating brain cells, you kind of got it and said, oh my God, it's going to happen. It's going to take a while. And some things took longer and some things happened faster, but it was right there. And you said, how can I jump in and make it be a part of this? And so that's what I did.
As a consumer who obviously was not a programmer, I remember email. I sent my first emails right around 1992 or 1993, if I'm not mistaken. That was sort of when I became aware of its existence, and when I knew the first maybe two people who also happened to have an email address.
So what were you doing? Were you dialing into something to get the connection? How do you remember what you were doing then?
I've used modem since the time when we still put it on the cradle.
Yes.
I used to use my grandmother's phone my grandparents were willing to spring for a computer. We kept a computer downstairs at their apartment. They lived below us. And we would put her landline into a little cradle.
Yep, a coupler.
Yeah, which at 14.4 baud's transmitted data to BBSs. We still use BBS systems. But that was before the time of email.
Yes. Yes, I was thinking, so 92, 93, when you did email, did you have a little dial-up? Or
yeah, I used 28.8 dial-up modem.
Yep, okay.
And I think, it was not Netscape. What was that? Was it something?
There was CompuServe, there was AOL. It depends if you were in Europe or US. So
I was 92. I moved to the United States in 92. And I have a distinct memory of first getting email. But obviously you were already, when did you start in earnest to develop Outlook for Microsoft?
So there's two parts, Outlook and Exchange. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the good stuff happened after I started the Microsoft email group, because the very first products were Microsoft email for Apple Talk Networks, which shipped for the first time in 1986.
Wow.
1987. So it was actually very early. And then the next thing came Microsoft Mail for PC networks. And so there was a lot of stuff happening in the 80s and early 90s. And then, only then, as Windows started to build, did Outlook start to become what's called a PIM, P-I-M, mm-hmm. Personal Information Manager.
Yeah. Where in that timeline do you feel that email actually reached critical mass where you could say, okay, you know what, now there's actually a network of people, not just people at huge companies who are incredibly savvy, but it is now actually becoming something that is available to a larger audience. And now we can really see that this is coming to fruition.
I actually feel that was later in the 90s, actually. You know, when we look back, we think, oh my God, you know, it should have happened 100 years ago, but it really took a long time. when we look even this week, right, because you and I talked about iPhones mm-hmm. online, iPhones are like 5 years old in the best sense of the word. And so same with email. It really didn't start to get traction where lots of people understood how you could incorporate it into your life until the mid and late 90s. So,
do you think that it really took the popularization of the World Wide Web in order to really make that happen?
Oh my God,
is that a fair assessment?
For sure. It's more than a fair assessment because we spent lots of time in those late 80s and early 90s trying to understand what network or networks would become the place that people would be connected. And we didn't, this is not some fabulous revelation of me, but even Gates is on record saying we didn't know that the internet would become this public place, that this free place to do it. We thought it would be places that you would pay for access. So there you go.
That was actually one of the questions that I wrote down that I wanted to ask you about is Microsoft, I remember at some point, was actually in a way given a hard time for not recognizing what you just said, that there was a time when they didn't recognize how essential the internet and especially also tight integration with email would really be. And Microsoft made a few attempts. They later on tried Microsoft Network. They bought Hotmail at some point. But somewhere along there, it seemed that email went too, and this now we're talking much, much closer to where we are now. But at some point, there seemed to be a split where there was the kind of usage of email that was more based on a company-based and that used Outlook, that used Exchange. And then there was Gmail, Yahoo Mail, although Yahoo Mail eventually also lost out. And really, Gmail ended up being that other email model that really caught on.
I think that's fair. There are so many nuances into how those markets and adoption models mm-hmm. really occurred. But I think that that's totally fair. Microsoft had done such a really good job at being involved in how the world of commerce and companies had done their thing and had tailored the user interface and the daily tasks to people at work. And then along came other places and other offerings, as you mentioned, and they were super, super focused on just communicating amongst friends. So I think that's a really good take on it. At the same time, all of those entities, whether it was Google or Microsoft or Yahoo, were trying to attack the other segments. And perhaps the lesson learned is it's really hard when you're trying to appeal to one segment to jump over and get to the other segment.
And there is, of course, something else that you and I once discussed online. What's interesting to me also about that split is how that has now worked out. It never occurred to me that if you get free email, you're the product. And so I know, like you're free to laugh at me. I completely understand.
I'm not laughing at you.
No, but you should, because I did not understand that that is where things were going. And so the Outlook model and the Exchange model versus the Google model actually have some other aspects, such as the impact that it has when you use that email platform and your emails are read and traced by the email provider, in this particular case, Google, and are used for advertising that is then sold to third parties or also developers. That is extremely profitable, obviously, for Google because it fits in with the rest of their business model. But it's also not something I think, or at least not to my knowledge, Microsoft ever attempted to do or had any plan on doing with their email offering. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. I've followed Google since the S1, right? The registration for their IPO. And the important line about do no evil. And that's a very highfalutin kind of thing. And God bless them to try and do it. And they probably cross that line about a million times between mm-hmm. now and then. To be fair, what they do, what they have done, and I'm not going to represent that this is what they're doing currently, but historically, they would say that the text within your email is open to them to parse, to understand, to know what you are interested in, and then they normalize it to help their advertisers and others know what people are interested in. The way that's evolved over the years is probably different. I don't know. But it is different than the early days. I don't want to speak about Microsoft today because their offerings are in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And I haven't looked at their EULA, right? The EULA is the end user license agreement. I don't know if they say they can parse everything you've written.
It's an interesting question, John, that I will endeavor to look into. Please continue.
There you go. Yep. So you never know, but historically, they don't give a hoot about what's in your email. Their mission is to make money from using their intellectual property. And Google's mission has been to make money by offering advertising to you. And I think they're both very good models. Mm-hmm. And as long as the consumer understands, then they can make really good choices about how they use them.
At what point do you think, we discussed earlier, you brought up the idea of people sending flame mail. At what point in the development cycle did email security and safety become an issue that you recall?
That's really easy. At the very beginning, so here's a little inside story. I personally brought our encryption methodologies to the powers that be in Washington so that we could get an export license to be able to offer, back then, what was such a rudimentary product as Microsoft Mail for PC networks. But I personally brought that stuff so that we could show the powers that be the kind of encryption we were using. Now, let's fast forward to today, where you can absolutely find software that theoretically can encrypt stuff. After having been a student for two or three decades of encryption and the world of encryption, I wouldn't expect that anything in the world is perfect, but I think that lots of stuff is at least safe from most malevolent intruders.
I guess my consumer side outlook on this is a little bit less rosy than yours. What we saw in the last election cycle, for instance, was a whole story about deleted emails, hacked emails.
Yes.
It is still an incredibly useful vector, I think only possibly beaten by the vector of Adobe Flash for hacking and for spear phishing, for all kinds of nasty doings. Or why do you think it is that after this many years, after being one of the really the earliest technologies that we've used for communication on this burgeoning internet, why do you feel that we have not been able to address those challenges in a more thorough and useful way?
The simple answer is that to build a user interface that tries to anticipate that spear phishing is still pretty complex. It's hard. And at the same time, to tell someone to be aware of spear phishing is actually pretty simple, right? To say, look out for that email alias that you don't know, right? Because I do it at least once or twice a month with my family.
So do you feel that's a failure on companies educating their users more so than it is on the technology side?
Oh, no, I think it's both. I think it's both the technology side trying to think about, and it's getting better from what I see. And again, I'm not super current because I'm not in the bowels of Google and Microsoft right now as they try and figure it out. But I think they're doing better. And I think that users are doing better. But still, What was the most recent thing? I'm not trying to side rail or, you know.
No, go ahead.
But how did the Russians, I'm calling out another country, but they littered a parking lot with USB drives, right? Mm-hmm. And then someone just picked it up and put it in their computer, and voila, they were inside everything. Mm-hmm. Users, 1 out of 100 is all you need, so that spear phishing or intrusion or anything that compromises something can be unwound and intruded upon.
Yeah, I also, part of me feels like companies are hesitant to put the onus on their user in the sense of how long it has taken for Apple to say, okay, you know what, we are going to do two-step security on your phone.
Oh, for sure.
And no company wants to be the first one to do it for fear of losing users, ease of use, and therefore being supplanted by a different system that does not require this two-step security. That seems to me to be one of the reasons why more companies haven't stepped up and said, you know what, we can make this more secure. You may have to enter two things instead of one, but on the flip side, the chances of you getting intruded upon are much less.
100%. You're right on about that.
Mm-hmm. So companies, start demanding more from your users. It's okay.
Demanding more from your users and being smart about how you build your infrastructure.
There have been a few reports that I've read or stories that I've read about how email is dying, how it's no longer the de rigueur way of communicating for the younger generation. If I send my children an email, the chance of them reading it is basically zero. Do you think email is dying, or is it still going as strong as it was, say, 10 years ago?
Oh, I think there's a mix for sure, because email has some advantages, but text and every other form of social media is a mixture of how people communicate. And there's voicemail. And if you're an iPhone user or a MacBook user or an Apple Watch user, there's a mix of how you're doing it today and tomorrow. So email is just one small part. Sometimes email is helpful to get big attachments to you. Sometimes it's happier and helpful to send a link. So I think it depends. And every day I talk to people, they go in and out of different things. Millennials, younger people, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, they got their phones and they boop, boop, boop. But there's still email around, and we're in transition.
Yeah, we're in transition. I think the fact that it's still part of the Apple iPhone stock configuration probably is helping email right now more than it's hurting it, that's for sure.
Probably, and you know, that Apple email, it can scoop up, if you configure it right, it can scoop up everything if you want, and that's your user interface. So,
right, exactly. So that was the email part of our conversation. Do you feel like I left anything important out that we should know about as far as email is concerned?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the early days were pretty fun, and even Apple and Microsoft collaborated on those, and maybe someday in the future.
Oh, really? We'll talk about it. Yeah, that would be interesting to hear. What happened there? There was a collaboration at that point. That was before Apple was inspired by Windows to do a whole new interface.
in the very early days, well, the first product from Microsoft was Microsoft Mail for Apple Talk Networks. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave you with that there. And if at some point in the future you want to pursue that, we'll talk about that.
Yes. I would love to hear about that. The early days. I love those. It brings me back to my childhood. I enjoy it greatly. Let's see what we have here in that case. So once this Microsoft Seattle adventure, Redmond was a thing of the past, where did you go next?
Well, I stayed with Microsoft. We moved to Boston. We built a big group that was working with all of Microsoft's biggest accounts. And that's what I did then. And then did some VC things and headed off into the future.
And what did that future look like for you? What piqued your interest?
Well, the biggest thing was 9/11 happened, and then I started to help the intelligence community during that what seemed like and was a dire time in 9/11, and did some things to help understand a lot of the data world that was going on there.
I'm assuming that it is probably not something that I'm going to get a lot out of you from. Be safe to say.
It was a while ago now, and a very important time, and there were some just great people, and I learned a lot about how great this country is and the people there on both sides of the aisle, and how you can combine and hold hands and do stuff together. And that's what keeps me going.
So once you stopped your super secret project or projects, what drew your eye next?
Well, I didn't get my eye drawn as much as I was asked to join a healthcare system, and me, a tech guy, didn't know nothing about tech in the sense of healthcare.
Healthcare. No, healthcare is an interesting point. Nobody these days talks about healthcare, of course. So we're so tell us all about your healthcare adventure in that case.
I joined the board of a healthcare system in Boston and learned a lot about it, and have been trying to, you know, make a little bit of an impact on that stuff.
What was it that they needed you to do at that point, as far from a technology standpoint?
It wasn't even technology, just being some crazy guy from the outside that would say, in healthcare, you need to have a positive cash flow. You need to have a good balance sheet. You need to have some discipline, because there's something called fee for service. Mm-hmm. And those three words governed everything, which simply said, if I can bill you, I'll get paid. And that's how we, I think, lost our way. And I was thrown in as my first board meeting, I was thoroughly frightened, because I'm not a stupid guy, but going into something that I knew nothing about was a little intimidating. But after one or two board meetings, I understood that this was like most any other board meeting, where you're trying to figure out, how do you help this institution survive and move forward? And in fact, make a profit, because every organization, even a non-profit organization, should make a profit.
So often, healthcare is described as an insurmountable challenge, because there are so many forces at play that are politically very savvy, politically very powerful. What was the most difficult to get right or to get under control?
So to plant a seed for back then and then for today... back then, the system was Boston-based, and today, amazingly, it's a national company. So their outlook today is across about a dozen states, number one. Number two, fee-for-service meant and means, and still means in our healthcare system, you know, that you go in and you go in for a visit, or you go in for a hip replacement, and there's a certain amount of money paid for that, and it happens no matter what. What we're doing is what the industry is truly trying to do, with lots of road bumps and speed bumps, is unwind that to figure out, how do you keep people healthy? Mm-hmm. And how do you start with a baseline that helps you find a place where you're healthy, and how a healthcare system can help you along that trajectory. And that's what's the most important thing about what's going on today. It is really hard. It is confusing. It is, of course, devastating when you're faced with something life-threatening. And so we have a long way to go.
Well, I'm not sure how much Boston Children's and Dana-Farber are part of your of that particular health system's purview, if they are privately run or if they're part of that system. But just in case they are part of that system, had it not been for Boston Children's and Dana-Farber, then our daughter would no longer be with us. So for whatever little piece you had in bringing that to where it is today, I thank you, sir. That the difference between being treated in Los Angeles at CHLA and being treated in Boston meant the survival of our child. So and that happened because of the capabilities that Boston had, that CHLA, which has been great to us, but nonetheless did not have. They used newer technology and they used a methodology that was not used in Los Angeles, and that is what ended up making the difference.
I am a little speechless, and
Sorry, I didn't just mean to drop that on you.
no, I will claim nothing. I will share that my sister was at Dana-Farber a long time ago, and that Boston is a good place, and there are so many good places around and in the country, and it depends on what's going on. And I am so thrilled that you shared here with me, but in the podcast. And we'll talk more about that too.
Yeah, they're an amazing they're a pretty amazing place. But they are, of course, associated with Harvard, so they have some capabilities, I guess, that others just
Well,
may not.
I'm also a good person to throw stones at Harvard since I'm a native Bostonian, just.
What kind of stones are you throwing at Harvard, sir?
Oh, just because they're Harvard, why not? When you're local, you can do those things. You just keep everyone in their place, and that's a good thing.
One thing that fascinates me about healthcare, and I'm not sure that that is at all your, if that is not at all what you're interested in, then you will let me know. But systems integration seems to be a really interesting topic, particularly in the medical field, because there are so many disparate systems, computer systems, trying to talk to each other, or actually not talking to each other. And that makes a lot of the work that hospitals and healthcare providers do seemingly harder than it really needs to be, mostly at the expense of the consumer, of the patient. Is that something that you've done any work on or that you've taken any interest in?
So you're killing me because I feel like I should bang my head against the wall because the past 3 to 4 years, that's what I've spent some time on. It's an ephemeral space because there's a lot of data that can be integrated. It's a space in technology that's still up in the air. People talk about data lakes. They talk about data warehouses. They talk about fabulous algorithms. They talk about silos. And there are some very useful offerings and platforms out there. What's hard is that the healthcare people, the organizations, have limited budgets and their margins, right? The margin is the difference between their profitability and their little cushion of what they can invest back into their business. The margins are so thin that it's really hard, unlike Amazon or Google, and I'm not making an example of them. But so it's very, very hard. But there are some really good platforms that can help them. So there is some light at the end of the tunnel. I have been spending the last 2 or 3 years of my professional life trying to figure out if there's something we can do. And I'm feeling good, but it will take a while for that to happen.
Is that are you familiar with Paladin's work at all?
Oh yeah. Well, I used to live down there, so you'd walk around and those crazy people were walking around everywhere.
They've definitely done some interesting experiments there.
I always felt creeped out when I would see the local security people. I was like, dudes, this is Silicon Valley. It's not supposed to be like we're walking around the CIA here, but yeah, they were out there.
In a really interesting company. For those of us not familiar with Paladin, you can Google their good work. There was a pretty interesting article lately about the work that they do in the security and national security space, not necessarily for the United, or just for the United States, but elsewhere as well.
Well, I'll have to read about that, and we hope that
that they're on the side of the good guy. We hope that they're on the side of the good guy is what we hope.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But data integration, definitely one of those interesting aspects of healthcare. Are there other aspects to healthcare? It has been such a prominent issue. It's said to be, again, the top issue for the midterms. What are your feelings about healthcare personally?
Personally, number one, I think people kind of get that there is some communal nature about healthcare. I think that people do. But we'll see if the American public feels that way, like the rest of the world. Number two, going back to data integration, it might take another 5 years, but even this past week, as we record this, I had the pleasure of being on a number of conference calls with healthcare executives who are doing pilots and working hard to integrate data to help their members understand more about themselves and being able to reach out to them to keep them healthy. So not to just deal with that crisis, but to know them, to understand their daily lives, and to help guide them a little bit or a lot to lead healthier lives.
So we're going finally from the treatment model to a preventive model, and treating people or supporting people when they don't really need to be treated, but when they need to be their best healthy selves.
There are early signs of that, and part of it will be able to discern how well it's working across a range of demographics. Mm-hmm. It's one thing, you know, to take that well-to-do kind of suburbia
who
has the wherewithal, but also then to reach into an inner city with a desert of supermarkets, right? You know what a desert of supermarket, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
A food desert, and try and help them live a day-to-day life. And so we're going to see, but there's, you know, early indications of that. And that's driven by, let's go way back, not to be too political, but to Obamacare and to those drivers of healthcare economics to say, let's focus on this. Let's focus on trying to help people figure out how to be healthy.
I had actually a really interesting conversation a while back with our friend Bill Myers at Bill Cap Hill, also been a guest on the POTUS Press Pool. But yes. I had him on a really interesting podcast, and he was actually saying how he had observed that the places that were worst served, that were in news deserts, also ended up being the ones hardest hit by the opioid epidemic, and also ended up being most reliably Trump voters, which I thought was interesting.
Yes.
Is that something that is borne out by your experience?
I wouldn't say borne out by my experience. But my inner gut jumps up and goes, you know, holy shit, yes. If there's anything positive that could come from the Trump presidency, is this understanding, this insight, and this willingness for someone like me, you know, that didn't know that I should engage with friends, lifelong friends, who were Trump supporters, and trying to understand what the heck you're talking about, or what did you do, or why was this something that you felt compelled to do, and to listen and to try and get it. Because we, in this case, some of my friends, we grew up together. And so it wasn't like there was this disparate, it wasn't like some dude from Iowa or Michigan, right? This was someone from my town in Massachusetts. And understanding and learning and getting that. Or if now you're in West Virginia, and you're in a coal mining town and you're inundated with some kind of opioid crisis and you can't break out from your community and you don't feel like you're a part of the American dream, what happened to you and how can we make it better?
Important question that I believe the Democrats fell down on during the past 8 years to understand, to appreciate, and to really help or offer any kind of significant improvement.
Amen. Yes. 100%. 100%.
Do you feel that any of that is going to change over the midterm? Do you think that Democrats now get something that they didn't get during those 8 Obama years?
Well, you know, as you and I speak, we're in the midst of the, you know, neutron bomb above our heads of the Kavanaugh appointment mm-hmm. and all that's going on. Having said that, and knowing that 2 weeks ago it was all about Anonymous and Bob Woodward, good Lord knows whatever you and I are talking about around Halloween, Daniel, we're probably talking about, I don't know what we're talking about around Halloween.
No idea.
Right? No idea. As we approach back around then, it'll be 10 days until voting time. So, I don't know. I think my gut right now says that I trust, I'll be really honest, I trust women to rise up and understand what the past few months, maybe the past few years, have been about. Mm-hmm. And they will, the voting women, will figure it out and do the right thing. And that's in the background of the past week, almost every day, twice a day, as I have taken a 4-year-old to school, playing Mary Poppins. I can recite the words to Sister Suffragette perfectly. and you know, it's my biggest complaint, as I figure it out, is I try to get work done, but I am so devoted to our country and things that I want to be plugged in more than ever. And so I'm so distracted because I feel compelled to listen to Julie and everything else, so I know what's going on hour to hour. Someone sent me, a dear friend who's a Trump supporter, said, "Let it go, John, let it go." And I said, "No, I know we can make a difference, and I'm not going to let it." And it was a quote from the movie Frozen, and a reference to my granddaughter, right? That she would love the movie and Anna and Elsa, which, of course, I know totally. And I said, you know, I can't let it go. And I won't let it go.
Mm-hmm. Can you actually, I feel like we should, if you're comfortable with it, we should talk a little bit about how those interactions with your friends went, if that's something that you would be comfortable talking about.
Oh, sure. Very comfortable.
We haven't had a whole lot of that on the podcast. We've had people, many of them, who have avoided talking to their friends, or stop talking to their friends who are Trump supporters, or just get very quiet, or simply try to not talk about that, particularly if it's family, but also if it's friends. So I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about how your experiences went.
Oh, so there's a spectrum, let's say on Facebook, where there's kind of a distant friend that's such a Trump supporter and so rabid that I stopped engaging, and not just me, but some friends, and not stopped engaging, but just quiesced, to use that phrase, just because it seemed hard. So that's one point. But there are friends from high school, in college, who, whether it's messaging or email, that I've worked to exchange views on a range of things, and also relatives. And I haven't stopped. I've also bumped into people on Twitter who I've never met, who are from different parts of the country. Not lots of them, let's say a half dozen, not even. Mm-hmm. Who I enjoy exchanging, you know, snippets, because that's what Twitter is, of views. And Dan, you might have seen a little thread or here and there of people. I don't try and escalate, and the ones that might seem crazy, I just put to the side. But people who try and, especially with some wit, right? A little wit is really good, because it's politics, and this is still at its core a really good country. And of course it could go off the rails. Of course we could get segued some awful place. But let me go back to just after 9/11, and I got sucked into, in a very nice way, down into Washington and people who are trying to do good things. And I saw people from every spectrum. And I'm not a military person. I didn't serve in the military because I'm of an age where I was post-Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But I saw so many good things that I feel and always will feel good about the country. And I think that we are being tested. And I think that's probably good.
I was going to ask you, do you feel that any of those places that you experienced, as you're saying, in a very positive way at the time, in a time when America really needed to come together and figure some really difficult questions out quickly, do you feel that any of those people or institutions are currently under attack by the current administration for reasons that really has nothing to do with their quality, but has to do with the fact that information that they have, that they may have handled, that they may have provided, that they may have procured, is inconvenient and or damaging to the current administration?
Oh, holy shit, that's really easy. The answer is yes. and it's not that they have information that is damning, but just that they're there and understanding of reality, if I may. So I don't know what they have. And I truly hope it's not, you know, bad or anything. But just that they know and they get it. Whether it's understanding that a 17-year-old at prep school in this privileged place would be sucking down 100 kegs of beer a year, and or what our current president did for the past 30 years in living his life. They get the facts, pretty much, not everything. And we have to use that. There's a certain mirror of reflecting on ourselves, too, of who we are and what we're trying to do. So I'm not fearful of it at all. I really, really believe in the goodness of it. And at the same time, yes, I get that whether it's the federal government, the state government, that they can be incompetent, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's administering tax adjudication or how the police work, things can be really bad too. But I'm in the camp of saying that I personally, over a number of years, being inside certain kinds of institutions within Washington and other places, and inside certain kinds of institutions in, quote, big business, from, you know, Microsoft to Apple and places like that, that people were really good and were very explicit about what their goals were.
Well, I can't talk, for bigger corporations, but I'm just going to assume, John, that a good representation of what you're saying about this country's security in particular and the goodness of what happened after 9/11 is currently rather well expressed in what Robert Mueller is doing with his investigation, which seems to be run with the kind of professionalism and the kind of reliability and calm that expresses or stands for some of the best that our our government and our law institutions have to offer. And I think it currently stands in a sort of stark contrast to what's going on with our government, but at least at the top. But Mueller, for whatever comes out of that investigation, whether it finds culpability, whether it doesn't find culpability, however it goes, the fact that nothing leaks there, the fact that they're doing what they're doing in a, I think, convincing, lawful, and well-executed way, seems to me the kind of thing that gives me at least hope that American apparatuses still can do the things that impress around the world in their thoroughness and in their lawfulness and in their goodness, if you will.
I bet that Mueller sits there at night drinking water or sparkling water and thinks about how he's representing all of those folks that did vote for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And his incredible, what's the right word? His just responsibility to do everything to represent facts and truth. I agree. And his incredible ability to not leak.
Mm-hmm.
And to pursue the truth. And then lastly, you know, on my little credenza in my bedroom, I have a tiny version of the Constitution. And to just uphold that, to uphold what we're trying to do here in this lovely country, and fight places, like, as you know, I just was in China, to fight against, or to support them, to keep coming around, because China's, you know, they're trying. They probably won't get there with this iteration, but they're trying to mm-hmm. get to a better place.
What was your, since we're just talking about that, and I don't want to go on another little rant like I just did about Mueller, I apologize, but...
That was perfect. That was great.
I apologize. But what was your experience in China? You went with your family, I believe. And
yes.
So how was that experience? Had you been in China multiple times? Was it your first time? Or how was this trip to China different from maybe previous experiences that you had?
So to work backwards, multiple trips to Asia and all around the mainland. So Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Japan. First time, mainland. Trips to Shanghai
mm-hmm.
and Beijing. And the top level impression was people are fabulous. So, you know, being in the cities, amazingly westernized in so many places. Pollution, you know, that time of the year, on the high side, but not debilitating. And just an amazing presence of state, what I'll call state representatives, or on every corner, you know, some dude in like a little black outfit mm-hmm. watching what you're doing. So that was interesting. Was that an overreaction on my part? Maybe. But I don't...
You started seeing ghosts.
It's right. But I don't think so. You know, it's a monitored society, as we know, both right now growing technically and technologically, and just human-wise. That said, coming and going, traveling, enjoying daily life, enjoying sightseeing and restaurants, and was terrific. It was great.
Mm, sounds like a good trip. I've only been to the airport of Beijing. I've unfortunately never been to Shanghai or to Beijing, which is something that I need to finally put on my list and do again.
Yes, it was, I could go on and on. Shanghai, by far my favorite, but Beijing, you know, it's like going to D.C. and you get the history because you go to Great Wall, you go to mm-hmm. the Imperial Palace and all that stuff. But Shanghai, wow. I mean, for a tech guy, for a guy who enjoys big cities, Shanghai is amazing and at the same time sad, you know, little, you know, air pollution and grayness, but just mind-blowing 22 million people. Just for any person in the Western Hemisphere, a place to go.
Yeah, definitely have to see. I'm incredibly partial to Tokyo, so I know that my children are insisting on the fact that I finally take them to Tokyo.
Yes.
But then after Tokyo, Shanghai is definitely next. And then I would love to see Hong Kong again, because it's been a long time since I went there.
Hong Kong is fabulous, and the bullet train from Tokyo to pick your place.
Bullet train. We took the bullet train to Kyoto, which is a beautiful trip and also a beautiful city.
Yes.
Highly recommend Tokyo. I don't know whether we've had the Tokyo talk yet on this podcast, but we will at some point. I'm completely fascinated by Tokyo, probably my favorite city in the world to go to, because it is so not westernized.
Yes.
Have you been to Tokyo a lot?
Yes. Yes, back in the Microsoft days.
Oh, back in the Microsoft days. How was that? In the 1980s, you're saying?
Yes, 80s and late 90s.
How was that? I need to know everything.
Every meeting was like smoke-filled, you know. The Japanese mm-hmm. would be sitting there smoking their cigarettes, and it was like, okay. It was the best. It was just overwhelming with contrasts and the friendliness of everyone. And it was those early days of the computer stuff where even the center of the city, you know, was mm-hmm. it was still new. But I loved it. And I just loved getting on the train, and I loved getting on the bullet train. We go to back then, later in the 80s, we would go to Fuji. Mm-hmm. Because Fuji was the rival to Kodak. Mm-hmm. And part of my project was to understand where digital imaging was going. I'm checking. It says 10 o'clock, so we're already going on like a marathon session. And oh, no one's going to listen. No one's going to listen to this, Daniel.
You know what the best thing is about podcasting? Mm-hmm. I don't have to give a shit whether anybody listens to it or not, because nobody's going to cancel me if I don't have enough viewers. I just get to talk to really interesting, fascinating people, and whether or not somebody else approves is none of my concern. The exact opposite of your board meeting with the healthcare sector. I do not need positive cash flow. I'm just doing this because I enjoy it. Yep, that's what this is. So in this sitting, John, what is it that we should still talk about? So we have the digital imaging aspect, of course, which then leads into our good friends at Instagram and another pet project, and we haven't even talked about sailing. And we also have not talked about about Airbnb. So I don't even know where to start with you. You are too interesting, John. This is a problem.
I'd rather talk about Kavanaugh.
You'd rather talk about Kavanaugh than sailing? Yeah. Wow, that's okay. Let's hear it. What's your Kavanaugh?
There are two things I want to say. One is I become a more militant. Oh my goodness, should I say Democrat? In the sense that, you know, you look at the very good tactics the Republicans have used for the past 5, 10, 15 years. And so some of the things, Michael Avenatti, who, you know, is maybe specious, but pushing back. And then how things play out now.
I find it unfortunate, but I have to say that my feeling, and we discussed this briefly today with amongst some friends, my feeling actually was that if the Republicans did not get Kavanaugh, if for some reason the Democrats are able to fend this off, which might still happen, how do you think that would impact the voter turnout and the voter motivation in the midterms?
It might drive some Republicans more to the polls.
That was my feeling as well. And
yes, is that enough to like get Cruz elected? You know, it's hard. The other side, I'm talking out loud now, Daniel. You know, maybe a lot of them are like happy enough with what Trump has done. You know, they're going to chill out. We don't know.
I'm really curious. My feeling was that if they got Kavanaugh, then the Republican, one assumption would be that they're going to be so grateful. They're going to turn out in droves for this Trump because he's so wonderful. That to me would actually seem less likely. What would seem very likely is that they feel very sated and are like, you know what? Okay, we got what we wanted. And other than that, I don't really feel super compelled.
So my wild card for us talking is we don't know who and what and where all the women are mm-hmm. who have been impacted from this.
I totally agree. You know? Yep.
Right. And that's not even our friend Susan or Lee or the other people. Mm-hmm. It's this broad swath of not totally tuned in and just picking it up because they're single moms, right? Single moms who are so busy, mm-hmm. right? Or married moms who are so busy, right? They're working a job, but they got two or three children. And they're busy and they don't have a nanny and they're just trying to get it done and picking up the bits and pieces of what's going on in the real world.
There was a lot of criticism about how Obama, even though he did not have the votes, and I don't think that there would have ever been an opening for Garland, there was a lot of criticism about him not maybe taking every step that could have been taken in order to get Garland heard and possibly get Garland seated. Do you think that the Democrats have done what they needed to do or are doing what they need to do in this particular instance?
I'm not sure. And one of the fun things, it's not fun things, but very useful things that Julie has kind of enlightened me in listening to her is doing that post-Obama assessment mm-hmm. of what that presidency was like. Because I was swept up in, you know, the change and the possibility. And there were ACO, having been on a healthcare system board, I'm on board with what that meant and what it didn't mean. But Julie has been helpful in being discerning about what they did, what they missed, and what could have been done better.
Yeah, and I think that's a useful and overdue discussion, I think, to have.
Oh, yeah. Useful and overdue, and I'm trying not to sound so political and mm-hmm. say, you know, holy shit, they got stuff really effed up. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, one. May I ask you one last question?
You can ask.
Okay. This is a really easy one. How do you feel about? It's not. How do you feel about Obamacare and single payer? To get back to healthcare for just a second.
Oh, it single payer should happen. And Obamacare is the biggest step towards giving this country appropriate health care, period.
So single payer is one of those things where a lot of studies show or claim to show that single payer is just not financially viable. Is that, in your view, the case?
No, because it's a sleight of hand accounting issue. I mean, we're living in a world right now where this tax cut was passed that hit us with the most egregious imbalance in what is the national debt. So if we can unwind that and truly understand how single payer deployed with the right level of technology can help us give everyone good health care and at the same time control costs, I think we can get beyond the BS of why it could be expensive. Mm-hmm. I think that we're using the wrong numbers.
Interesting. That is very interesting. So are you Bernie curious at all?
Not necessarily because the BC, the Bernie Curious, is still hand waving, in my opinion. I'm more in the Obama camp of let's look at these numbers. Let me be specific. when you talk to payers, right, mm-hmm. the payers are the insurers and the providers, the people, the systems, the big healthcare systems, they're coming together and they're starting to think through how they can deploy programs and memberships and policies, you know, insurance policies that will cover people and provide levels of care that are good and that won't totally break the bank. Mm-hmm. So some of those have some tough decisions, right? Because the data says that a lot of the expense is in that last 5% of life. And so there are some tough decisions about how we deal with that last 5% of life. And it's not about death panels and those other things. Mm-hmm. It's truly about how we take elderly people, you know, someone 70 years or above, and how they live their lives and how they get care during challenging periods in their life. Mm-hmm. And I'm, in this case, I'm not talking out of my butt. I just finished 4 years of dealing with my mom from 85 to 88 years old and saw and lived how that works. Mm-hmm. So I have some real opinions on that. It's been hard. It's been hard inside healthcare systems, believe me, as these people, as these humans, whether they're administrators or physicians, moving from this fee-for-service world where, you know, if Daniel was just paid because he did a podcast, Daniel would be happy to do like 2,000 podcasts a month, right? That's fee-for-service, right? That's truly what healthcare has been like in the U.S., and we have to transition to something a little bit different, which is called, you know, value-based payment. And it's the system has been struggling to get there and to also provide coverage for everyone, because health care is a right. It is a right to come into this world and live a reasonably healthy life.
My friend, it has been an absolute delight to talk to you about many things. And as I mentioned earlier, I have several more things that I would love to talk to you about. But in the interest of time and not overly exhausting you on the first time around, I would suggest that we leave it at this.
This was more than a privilege, if mostly to have a dialogue and to talk.